Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we are going to talk about The Many Saints of Newark and Prisoners of the Ghostland, starting with The Many Saints of Newark, which is a prequel of the TV show The Sopranos. So I guess to start off with, Mike, were you a fan of the TV show The Sopranos?
Well, I was in a sense a fan of it because when I put together a course some years ago on the cultural history of television, I knew absolutely that had to be on the list. So at that point, you know, I was watching like a complete season, let's say, at a time, and really was taken by it, yes. And so it seems to me that that's a show that transcended the good ratings. By that, I mean it had a place in American pop culture and still does have a place there. And for that reason, because it was so self-contained, such a, you know, a striking program, I've been thinking a lot about this because the show went off the air in 2007, and yet it's still very much with us, if you will. And so when I heard that there was going to be this prequel, I asked myself, do we really need it? You know, and this is a more extended discussion potentially in terms of prequels and sequels and all that. But you know what? That was my question going into the movie. And honestly, watching the movie and then coming out of the movie, it was still my question, do we need this movie? So Marie, let me directly ask you that question.
I was a huge fan of the show. And in fact, I went on one of those bus tours where you go to New York City and while you're there doing whatever, you can get a tour of, they had two options. One was Sex and the City and the other was The Sopranos. So I went on both of them with a friend and they took you to all the spots you would recognize from the show, the Bada Bing nightclub, you know, we went inside and all kinds of places where they dumped bodies. It was very dark, actually. You found yourself was like, oh yeah, I remember this scene, but I didn't necessarily want to put myself in it. The Sex and the City one was obviously much more lighthearted and fun, but I mean, I was a big enough fan to go on the bus tour. But I'm with you on the necessity of this particular prequel, although in general, I love prequels, sequels, and I think most people do like prequels. You know, I'm thinking even with cartoon characters, you know, they still had to come up with like baby Looney Tunes. There's something fun about having established some characters and then find out, you know, who they were before they were famous kind of thing. So I think the opportunity for a prequel was a good one. I just don't think that this one hit the right mark, mostly because I think what made The Sopranos work for me was all of the interpersonal relationships that went with this crime family. So to me, the most interesting characters were Carmela, Tony Soprano's wife, and his psychiatrist, who was played by Lorraine Bracco. And you get a few seconds of young Carmela, which was, that's kind of fun. It's like, oh, all right, so this is what she looked like in high school. And I guess she and Tony knew each other back then and were friends, at least, if not, you know, involved. Those kinds of moments are nice. The characters they choose to flesh out, though, were not characters I was all that curious about to begin with. So it took me most of the movie to even figure out how the different characters fit into the ones that I already knew.
I wanted to follow up on that. And since you know the show so well, what struck me is that the main character in the film, you would think would be the young Tony Soprano. And he's there. They have a child actor playing him. And then they have Michael Gandolfini, you know, the son of the late James Gandolfini, actually. So he's there, but ironically, he's there and he's not there because the principal character, the main character in this prequel is Dickie Moltisanti. And the thing is, he's a character who never even appears on the TV show. So Marie, give me your feelings about that, because my sense is, I absolutely agree with you. We care about Tony in terms of his immediate family, those relationships, his relationship with his analyst. And that stuff, for the most part, doesn't exist in this prequel. And instead, we spend almost all the time with this character who, again, bizarre irony, isn't even on the original TV show. And I found myself wondering, like, well, who is this guy? Like, I felt like I was a little, it was almost like a little foggy that way. Wait a minute, why are we focusing on him? And then moreover, it was just sort of a standard issue, kind of generic gangster story where he was involved. And I just never felt totally involved there. I was never completely bored by it, but oftentimes felt like it was just a little bit off center. It just wasn't quite focused the way I would have wanted a prequel to be. I'm not particularly wanting a prequel, but if I'm going to have one, I really want to spend quantity and quality time with the young Tony Soprano. What do you think?
I agree completely. I kept waiting for them to bring the Tony character back on screen, especially since it is James Gandolfini's son. And, you know, the physical resemblance obviously works in his favor for the role, but it's really underwritten. There was one moment in the movie where he is, it's either, I think he's in the principal's office or the guidance counselor's office. So I can't remember the exact role, but that moment where the authority figure is trying to talk to him like an adult and get him to understand, you know, consequences and all these kinds of things, that had a moment of feeling like Lorraine Bracco in the TV show, where, you know, here's this strong woman who is able to speak frankly to him, kind of sets up the fact that later, you know, that would be, but, you know, you really had to reach for that, you know, to find that, because I was looking for certain characters to show up. And I didn't find the Dicky Moltisanti character that compelling. He seemed like he took up too much screen time. And I wonder, because it's written by David Chase, who's, I mean, not only wrote all the Sopranos, but, you know, he did the Rockford Files. So he knows about, you know, dialogue and how to write a script, obviously. And director Alan Taylor certainly knows what he's doing from previous work. But somehow I feel like they got ahead of themselves and thought, this is going to be like, you know, Godfather 1, 2, and 3, and we can just keep branching out characters and have an endless supply of audience members who want to see more about the family tree. And I think they should have focused more on Tony Soprano himself.
While we're piling on, let me pile on some more here, because it, not only is Dicky Moltisanti, you know, a character who essentially just exists in this prequel, but when you realize how distantly connected he is, at least, you know, when you talk about the family tree, that's what really has prompted me to truly pile on at this point. He is actually the father to Tony's distant cousin or something. I almost feel like you need the genealogy chart. And share your feelings about this, because as I was watching it, I kept thinking, okay, well, it's been a long time since the TV show was on, and maybe some of this was discussed or not, but I felt myself like sort of grasping and groping and wondering, well, wait a minute now, how exactly are these people connected? Do you ever have moments like that watching this film where you had to like remind yourself, okay, now there's this distant cousin and we spend time with him and he's a really troubled character and this is the father to him. And then you start getting into that family's connections. And I thought, well, wait a minute, this is not material that I knew from the show and I don't even fully know it now. Did it ever seem to you like a bit of a stretch where you found yourself questioning not just the script, but even yourself as to, wait a minute, how is this character connected to that character?
Yes, I think that was the major problem with the script, is that they assume that you have followed all the threads from the TV show and can plug people in. And it's even more bizarre that it's narrated by the Christopher Moltisanti character. He's talking to you from beyond the grave in the beginning, and then comes back to bookend that with the, you know, a similar kind of approach to signing off with the movie. And he's a big character in The Sopranos. And in The Sopranos, it was always made out that he was Tony's nephew. But, you know, they were closer than that because of the way they'd been raised or something like that. They did sort of address it on the show. But given that that character is so key, they could have done a lot more with him in the prequel. And some of the things that people will remember about The Sopranos is that he had a relationship with a woman that went for almost the entire season. You saw a real character arc and ins and outs of their troubled relationship. But she's not addressed at all in the prequel. And, you know, they give us a young Carmela and a young Janice. I thought that was a mistake. I think they should have at least planted that seed, because I think it would have been, people were looking for that character. Drea DiMatteo's character. But I will say this, one thing that I thought was absolute genius was Vera Farmiga as Livia, the mother, because I had forgotten for a moment what a horrible character she was in the show. And she was awful, like the worst mother imaginable. And then when I was watching it, I thought, oh, this is really capturing, I'd forgotten about how hateful she was to her kids. And then just having Vera Farmiga do the role, she was fabulous in it. I think she made up for a lot of things that I thought were really low points in this movie.
You know, what was surprising about that for me was in the TV series, Nancy Marchand is so indelible as Livia. It's such a great characterization that I kind of had, you know, almost like fear and trembling, like who are they going to put in that role? What's going to make it work? And I agree with you, Vera Farmiga, she makes it her own. You know, she's very convincing there. And a reminder of really what a kind of ominous and oppressive mother figure this is. I mean, it really is kind of daunting. I want to double back briefly on what you were saying earlier that, you know, we're focusing on Dickie Moltisanti. By we, I mean the film is, and, you know, he's the father to this distant cousin. The cousin himself, Christopher, you're right, is an important character. But remind me, refresh all of us on this again, that within the series, the Dickie character never appears on screen there, but the other members of that family, most of them are more known by reference than screen time. And kind of do the genealogy chart from here in terms of, you know, Christopher, obviously important character, and he's important in both the prequel and in the TV series. But then the father is just non-existent on screen, but other relatives within that immediate family, aren't most of them known either by reference or just more quickly in the series? Because it seemed like it was kind of free floating here where I thought, no, wait a minute, who are these people?
Yes. And I think from the series, I don't remember them ever talking about the other Moltisantis, which is ironic because Moltisanti means many saints. That's where the title for the movie comes from. It's really the Moltisantis of Newark. That actually, going into the movie with that title would have been so much more, it would have been a better title because I wouldn't have been lost for most of it trying to figure out why are we focused on this character. I did think that they maybe thought, well, this movie will do the Moltisantis, and then the next movie will pick up with some other aspect of the Sopranos. You know, maybe we do get some sort of Lorraine Bracco tie-in or something where they pick up threads they didn't pick up on this one. Maybe they're thinking it's supposed to be three movies.
Please don't even say the next movie. I really am not. I know I'm being stubborn on this point, but again, it was one of those TV series that I thought was so self-contained, despite that, you know, infamous open-ended finale to the series. Still, it was such a self-contained series. I wasn't looking for prequel or sequel. But Marie, now that you mention it, and jesting aside on it, with the way this prequel is set up, we actually could get, if we do get a further film, it would be actually probably ironically more about the Moltisantis, don't you think? I mean, just from the way they, not that I want that, but it seems to me with the way it's set up, it's almost predicated on learning more about them.
Well, I think they could name this one the Many Saints of Newark and then have the next one be some other family of Newark. And then the third one would be the Sopranos of Newark. I could see the strategy, but I'm just making that up. I don't know if they actually have plans for that. I also wanted to say, I thought Leslie Odom was interesting in the movie. I mean, he's always good in everything. They bring in, you know, the idea of the racial discord that was, you know, predated the Sopranos and how neighborhoods were formed and, you know, protection money was obtained and all of these kinds of criminal enterprises. But what did you think about that whole side story? Did that work for you? Because it felt kind of obligatory and even tacked on.
Well, here's where we might disagree slightly. Because I was so turned off by the Moltisanti family saga, if you will, or not so much turned off as just alienated, right? I wasn't really connecting with it. What I found most interesting in the film, in a kind of sociological sense, was the racial relationships and tension in Newark. A quick reminder, within the film, when it goes back to 1967, there is a child actor, William Ludwig, who actually plays the very young Tony Soprano. Okay, he plays him as an 11-year-old. And then when the film jumps to Tony at 16, that's where the real life Michael Gandolfini, you know, plays his late father's role. I mean, that's what we've been talking about. But as a reminder, you know, for all of us that within the film, because it does jump around in time a bit, you're going to have a child actor playing the even younger Tony Soprano. And that younger or youngest Soprano, if you will, when we see him in 1967, Newark is about to break out into a riot. And what's for me really very interesting, I think, in the film is the sense of you have neighborhoods that have been predominantly Italian-American that are changing in various ways. You know, the population of Newark is in flux, if you will, and there's a lot. So you not only have tension within mafia families, but then you obviously have tension between racial groups. And I actually found that footage quite interesting. So I understand what you're saying, that it feels kind of tacked on, and it does. But on a personal level, I didn't mind the fact that it was tacked on because I found it like inherently interesting just to see how ethnicity was playing out. And Marie, back to your point with the Leslie Odom character and some others, it's not just like a complete rift or tension between blacks and whites, basically, but also the fact that, you know, you have people working for each other. So you could have, you know, a black man working for a white mobster, that kind of thing. Or when I say working for, I just mean like business dealings even. And that I found actually kind of interesting in terms of, because they're trying to figure this out themselves. Newark is changing. And, you know, when you're in a mafia family or in their business, if you will, their underworld business, so much is about turf. Who controls the territory? Who controls this and that? And when things start to shift, and that goes way beyond whatever your criminal enterprise is, when the whole city is starting to change, things get nervous. And then at the point where actual rioting breaks out, I actually found that, as I say, that footage was compelling in places. But Maria, I agree, even though I said I think we might disagree on that, we do agree in the basic sense that the movie itself kind of heads off in a different direction with that. It does feel tacked on in that sense. It almost could be like the focus for a totally different movie, Newark in 1967. That would really work very well, and I think would work better than the Moltisanti's in 1967. What do you think about that?
I think you're definitely onto something. I want to go back to something you said about the hierarchy. Who's who? How do all these characters fit together? When I was trying to work that out while I was watching it, the Dickie Moltisanti character has a father played by Ray Liotta. And after this character's demise, he goes to visit his father's conveniently twin brother in prison. I don't remember these characters ever being mentioned in the original show. But anyway, I'm looking at it thinking, wait, isn't that Ray Liotta? And then I look it up and it's like, oh, well, you just make up a twin brother and you put him in prison. And then he gets to say all these pithy things and give all this great advice and say things, you know, like, pain comes from wanting and stuff like that. I will say, I hate to break it to you, but I do think they were setting up another movie because they do end with the Christopher Moltisanti character saying from beyond the grave, as they end with a shot of Tony Soprano, this is the man I went to hell for. So it's like they've said, like, here's him, you know, as a child, but, you know, there's another piece missing between that where they left us and where the TV series picks up.
Marie, here's what makes it even weirder. We've been talking about how within the TV series, Dickie Moltisanti is a character we don't see, just, you know, verbally referenced, if you will. And then the really weird thing in this prequel, or even yet weirder thing, is now suddenly he's the focus of the film. And moreover, he's got a father. And yeah, Ray Liotta is an actor that you pay attention to, right? And so then it goes there. And then this whole notion of, well, no, wait a minute, you know, who's in the prison cell? And then not only that, as if all that weren't enough, it's the father who then, one of the subplots, who decides to bring a much younger wife over from Italy. And those scenes actually work independently on their own. You know, just the tension between an older Italian-American mobster and a young Italian woman who doesn't even speak English at first, and that on their own. But you know what? It again throws the movie sort of off kilter and takes it even further away from the young Tony Soprano. Whether Tony at 11 during the riots in Newark, and those riots in Newark already take you off topic, right? Or at least, you know, take you in a somewhat different direction. So that takes you not only away from the young Soprano at 11, but, you know, then the Soprano at 16 and so on. There are whole stretches of the film, and I wasn't looking at the watch there, but it was almost like, okay, 10 minutes here, 15 minutes there, where you'd be totally removed from Tony Soprano at any age. And suddenly you're watching not just Dickie, but Dickie's father with this young Italian bride. And I thought, wait a minute. And Maria, although I hate to say this out loud, because I'm not looking for more sequels and or prequels, but my goodness, there is a lot of material there.
There definitely is. Well, short is, I think I wanted to be Goodfellas, or at least a feature length episode of The Sopranos. And I think it pretty much missed the mark. Which brings us to Prisoners of the Ghostland. And since we have been talking so much about how much The Many Saints of Newark was confusing, that's what I want to lead with. All right, I'm first going to start off by saying it's a Nicolas Cage movie. That man is always in weird stuff, but this is weird even by Nicolas Cage's standards. Now, I understand that he really wanted to work with this director, Sion Sono. And because I didn't know anything about this director, I spent the whole movie just going, what is going on? I mean, it is just the weirdest movie. All right, so I wanted to quote somebody else's description of it. He says, it's like you had laced shrooms and bad LSD at Burning Man in a Japanese desert. And that kind of is an excellent description of this movie. All right, so Mike, starting off with this, I mean, were you confused? How much do you know about this director? How'd you like Nick Cage in it?
Well, Marie, let me start off with a statement that will clear myself in any court. Namely, there is no way in the world I would ever recommend that you watch this movie. You know, if you like Nick Cage because he's in weird movies, there's weird interesting and there's weird boring. And this is weird boring in the sense that I could give you a basic plot summary and I can sort of trace how certain characters fit together, But beyond that, you just sit there befuddled by it. It really is what I call a head scratcher of a film. One reason is that the director, and I know this Japanese director mainly by reputation, so I've read about, you know, other films by the director, but the director prides himself on, you know, sort of pushing the envelope that way in terms of weirdness. And that, but I'll say for this film too, another thing that makes it problematic is that on the one hand, I'm oftentimes intrigued by what I call genre mashups. On the other hand, I sometimes sort of wonder, do they even know what they're doing here? It's just like, what the heck? Let's do this. Let's do that. Just toss everything in. And this film is, if you said, well, genre-wise, what is it? Or what is it mashing up? I would say, well, it's a samurai Western. And I would say, you know, there's certainly precedent for that. And Marie and I, as film professors, often talk about this, whether you're talking about Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai or, you know, a Hollywood version, Magnificent Seven. I mean, we have so many examples going back decades of samurai movies that are learning from the Western. And certainly Kurosawa knew Western movies. He loved John Ford. And then conversely or correspondingly, you have Hollywood directors who are big fans of that. And so you end up with, you know, Hollywood Westerns or Hollywood sci-fi films or you name it that suddenly have samurai action. In fact, think about a lot of the big blockbusters we watch, the action-packed films we watch, how often there's gunplay, there's car chases, and at a certain point, you'll have some martial arts tossed in. And maybe even, you know, is that a samurai sword or a lightsaber? I mean, you have those moments where things are mashed up. So in theory, it's interesting. In practice here, I think it's a muddled mess. I think this film is a mess. And even though Nick Cage is oftentimes quite watchable, even in otherwise dreadful films, here he seems kind of muted. Here he seems like he's almost bored himself by it. He's just kind of walking through a lot of the scenes. What do you think about that?
I agree with everything you said. While I was watching, I was trying to figure out who this would appeal to. You have to be a hardcore Nicolas Cage fan to sit through this movie. And I thought it reminds me of Mad Max meets From Dusk Till Dawn. But if you liked either of those movies, you won't like this one. Ironically, even though it has elements of both of those to it, it doesn't hold together the way those two movies do. But I will say this, if you are curious about, you know, well, maybe I like weird. I'll give weird a try. Take a look at the poster for the movie. It's the super saturated colors, kind of gets across a kind of a creepy vibe just with the poster. But you can tell from the poster that this is going to be a color extravaganza. And if you could watch the movie with the sound off, so you weren't really paying attention to the plot, if you just watch the visuals unfold, there are some moments in there that are truly extraordinary. You know, just the use of color, the use of imagery, just the audaciousness of some of the things that the cinematographer and the director put together. That stuff I actually thought was pretty impressive. And had the script been just a little bit better, I could see this being a cult classic.
Marie, you're making me laugh as you say this because I'm thinking here, it's like the ultimate backhanded compliment. You're in effect telling the audience, watch the poster, don't watch the movie. And building on that in a more serious way, there are individual scenes or even this to say individual shots that visually are striking, but that's a case where then, okay, if you could just watch like a 10-minute highlight reel, you know, it might be more interesting that way. But we should talk about the ghost of a plot here somewhat, because it does have a storyline of sorts. There's a samurai town ruled by an evil governor, if you will, and he's, you know, sending the Nick Cage character. And this is not a light film. This is a very heavy-handed film. Guess what? Nicolas Cage's character is named Hiro. I mean, you know, you get these like really, really like clubbing you over the head references. And in fact, he has a partner named Psycho, right? So we're at that level. But essentially, he's been hired out now or sent off to go rescue a young woman in the Ghostland. Why is it Ghostland? Well, because there's been some nuclear holocaust and it's sort of a Mad Max type world. You're absolutely right about that. And then beyond that, it's almost like anyone's guess as to what's going on sometimes. But that's the schematic of what I call the ghost of a plot. You've got Samurai Town, you've got Ghostland, and you've got Nick Cage as the character who'll go from one to the other because he's got orders to rescue her. And in fact, he's wearing a bodysuit with explosives in it, which in effect sort of guarantee he'll do the job, because if he doesn't, as they keep saying, they could blow him up. I mean, do you want to add to that a bit? Because I'm calling it the ghost of a plot. Maybe there's some more we could add to it. Give it a little more presence and not so much ghostliness.
You know, it would have to be ghosts, plural, of a plot, because it is all over the place. It's like they just decided to try everything they ever wanted to put into a movie and just figured, why not? It really does. The story does not hold together in the slightest. But, you know, since we pretty much panned this movie, I want to say that I looked up the director to see, because I, you know, I was reading interviews with Nick Cage where he said he just really wanted to work with this director, and this director really is a fan of Nick Cage. And I thought, well, you know, with that much, you know, mutual admiration, you know, I can see why they would have wanted to work together. What is this director? What am I missing? And all right, so he's known for a lot of weird movies with characters who are either outright dystopian or fringe dwellers. I think that's where he likes to start his stories, you know, stories about teenagers who all commit mass suicide kind of thing. Seriously. And so I'm looking up, seeing, well, what could I watch that he's got out there? Nothing's available on Netflix. And of what's available on Amazon Prime, it's really very few and far between. Most of the things that I read about can't be found. You can't even buy the disc and watch it yourself. So he's, you know, he's an outlier out there. He's well known for being sort of the subversive Japanese director, but it's actually pretty hard to find his stuff. But when you do, this is all of a piece. This looks exactly like the next film he would have made. And so it makes sense. So if you follow this director, you'll probably think this is a great movie, but I'm giving it a pass.
Based on what we watched and how much I hated it, I'm actually thankful that I'm not able to watch anything else by him. I didn't think I'd find myself saying that, but you know, I'm content just to read descriptions of some of these other films, because it truly is a matter of taste there, if you will, if we can use the word taste even. But if he has any skill or talent, it's very much as a cult director. But cutting through that on a more serious note, you can understand completely why Nicolas Cage, of all actors, would be drawn to a director like this.
Yes. And I think that's the final word on that subject, because here we are at the end of our show. But don't forget to check out our other podcasts at dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us under Dragon Digital Radio on Spotify and Pandora. And we will see you at the movies.
See you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.